Good morning. We are live May 5th, 2022 here in Belgrade. Now, today actually happens to be Cinco de Mayo, the 5th of May. Sometimes we call that Cinco de Drinko. And it's interesting because it's not Mexican Independence Day, as is sometimes like often misunderstood, but in fact has to do with the Battle of Puebla and the destruction of the French army by the forces of the Mexican Republic. And it's not just about some battle. Why were the French mobilized in Mexico? And this goes back quite some time. You know, the history of Mexico with its empires and republics and the centralist and federalist regimes, multiple empires, multiple republics. It's actually very similar, most similar to France. Fifth Republic, Sixth Republic, like it's most similar to France, you know, with the back and forth between republics, empires, and I guess you had the Bourbons popping back up too in between Napoleons. Anyhow, so you had, I think, Napoleon III trying to impose on Mexico. This is actually going to tie into Ukraine. This is actually going to tie into Ukraine. Very much just like Ukraine. Mexico, prior to the Republic, had been ruled by different monarchs with ties to the various families of ruling monarchical noble families of Europe. There were Habsburgs, etc. Now, very interesting to us is how a country like Ukraine got itself into a mess of having leaders, officials, government that sell the country out and take on a lot of debt and receive a lot of kickbacks for putting a tax burden or an austerity regime on their own people just for them, for those individuals to get ahead personally. So this had happened also in Mexico. It happens in many countries. It's actually much more the norm than the exception. And that's why it takes ever vigilant citizenry to always be engaged in the public life. Etymology of the word idiot is a person unaware and uninvolved in politics. That's what the word idiot means. Idiot. Look it up. Idiot. A person unaware and uninvolved in politics. And now, of course, the young should be young and to live their lives. But you get to a certain point in life, and your obligations and your routine has stabilized. And it only takes, you know, a tithing of your time to dedicate towards politics. And we don't mean politicking or electioneering. We mean understanding the world, making time with people in your interest circle, in your affinity group, your family, colleagues, coworkers, friends, social, however, to talk about these things in, you know, the normal way, not in a moralized, not in a lecturing way, not in a public service announcement way. Don't check your friends. Don't, not in the call out culture sense of the word, but just the way normal conversations happen between people who get along and talk. It's so important to dedicate time to doing politics, influencing people's opinions, and that it makes a difference, and that power is very transitory. Power is like water. Power changes hands every day. Power is situational. It's contingent. It's subjective. It's not absolute. It's not all-encompassing. That is a technique or gargoyle effect, a method used to project far more power than one really has, like a porcupine or a blowfish. Or when a bear stands up, and you know, they tell kids, you know, if a bear comes up to you, put your backpack over your head so you appear taller. That's not because you want to have a conflict. That's because you're trying to avoid a conflict. And those in power, the elites, I mean, all of the money that, for example, Bill Gates have is basically, I don't know, $2,000 or $3,000 from each American citizen. So if you multiply that out into the world, it's a far less amount of power money. In other words, people all combined have more financial weight than he does. We just come together in very funny ways because it's like herding cats, right? But that's the essence of politics, is getting people together on these agendas. So what happened in Mexico, in, you know, going back, right, 200 years ago, the Mexican revolutionary process, which is like over 100 years long. Imagine a permanent revolution going a century. So anyhow, the French had basically gotten their own puppets into power in Mexico. And surprise, surprise, Mexico took on debt from France. Other countries, too. And so when Mexicans sort of came together and established the Mexican Republic, they looked at these things that these false imposed leaders had made, these crony deals, like within their own family members, basically, to transfer money and pose that as a tax to pay back a debt onto everyday Mexican people. So this was unacceptable. So you have these figures like Benito Juarez, and he basically, he's running Mexico. He's like elected president, and he writes a letter saying, we're not paying this insane debt anymore. And so France decided to invade. And at the Battle of Puebla, they were routed, they were defeated. And it was the beginning of a number of ultimately defeats. And the French occupation would be ultimately upended, and France would leave Mexico. I think never to return. So that's what Ukraine needed to do. But instead, and we talked about this last time, the great tragedy of Ukraine is that all of the radical voices of dissent, all of the thinkers, intellectuals, activists who see problem with late modernity, the cultures of late modernity, who see the problem of the oligarchy, of the oligarchs running Ukraine, who see that things like national identity or the national idea are proven, you know, your opinions about them notwithstanding, are proven bulwarks against globalization. So the tragedy of Ukraine is that all of those forces and all of those possibilities are subsumed and trapped within the rubric of Nazism. Imagine that you are being told, on the one hand, we must be European, and we must embrace the European Union's idea of Europe, or the alternative is to become some kind of kid brother to Russia. And between those two choices is not very attractive to a lot of Ukrainians born after 1970, because this was the generation that, when they came of age as teenagers in the middle 80s, actually were exposed to, all throughout the Soviet Union, to high amounts of westernization, or the direction that far Western culture began to pivot after, you know, we talk about May of 1968, of course referring to the big worker and student uprising in France. But it set off this chain of, well, the Situationist International, the so-called SI, and sort of committing after that the left in the direction of identity and culture and lifestyle, as opposed to the old labor, organized labor left, the old worker power-oriented left of a bygone era. And so what was big at the time in the Soviet Union was electronic music coming from France. This was huge in the 70s. This was huge in the 70s. And in Ukraine, Kiev, you know, Odessa, the big cities, Kharkov. And there were like discotheques and stuff, like they call them discotheque. And this lured a whole generation of young people coming of age in the 80s, 70s and 80s, into this ultra-consumer culture. And this is where the disco and cocaine thing really exploded. This had a huge undermining effect on consciousness in the Soviet Union. And it was, as I have explained consistently, this was an intentional, some people talk about the Tavistock Institute and so forth. This was an intentional power play of soft power by the far west elites to create a ultra hedonistic culture, to create that as the definition of freedom, whereas freedom had been defined differently in the past. It became a very personal, do what thou will shall be the whole of the law, satanic Anton LaVey sort of concept of freedom. Extreme hedonism. And the thinking was that this was going to undermine the developing world at a faster rate than it would undermine the developed world, the so-called developed, the West. And that the costs of doing so would be able to be eaten by the developed world, because they can build a prison industrial complex, they can create a safety net, they can have a mobile, you know, needle, clean needle supply, whatever, shelters. All of the fallout of extreme hedonism, and to promote that through, there was the thing that kicked off first in the black community, with the blaxploitation genre, blaxploitation films, totally derailing and trying to undermine progress made by Black people, Black communities in all areas of life. You could see there was a positivity movement that pushed back against this that was gaining traction in the 80s with the Cosby Show, Lionel Richie. I know that sounds funny, but these were all positive depictions and were not limiting. You could do all kinds of things. The Black identity was growing. You could be not just a musician or an athlete. You could be a doctor. You could be a lawyer. You could be an engineer. You could be a priest. You could do different types of music, not necessarily urban, not necessarily funk or soul or R&B. You could do anything. Why do you have to be tracked? And there was a lot of things happening in the West, good and bad. But you can see how they use culture to ultimately undermine people's sovereignty using a ruse, a sort of semi-sovereign, you know, hedonistic, do what thou will, shall be the whole of the law type of approach. This had a debilitating effect on the Soviet Union because World War II, much like in the United States, had shaped a whole generation and had gotten people, and much more so in the Soviet Union, I think, where they lost 70 million people, that may have been the entire conflict, but they took the brunt of that. And this brought people together. But for people that had been born 30 years after the end of World War II, these values were not their values. Things had been imposed. Things looked artificial. You have a one-party government. You have access now because of Voice of America and Radio Free Europe. People also traveled some, and they knew about this world in Western Europe. And the Soviet Union did import a lot of that stuff. But it led largely to the rise of cocaine, prostitutes, and oligarchs. But first, it had to be an ideal that was promoted in films like Scarface, or we mentioned the blaxploitation genre, but also gangster films, mafia movies. These had a big effect on Russian culture. So this is the great tragedy of Ukraine. Because now Russia was able to, as this plane was going down, now we're not talking about market, socialism, communism, capitalism. We're talking about the sovereignty of a state, its institutions, the obligations, and how those are set up. Where's the enforcement? Where are the mechanisms? These are mechanical aspects. There's levers and gears, if you can visualize it. Do the oligarchs have more power than the state, or does the state have more power than the oligarchy? Or to be more clear, are the oligarchy statists or are the oligarchy plutocrats who simply manipulate the state towards their own personal attainment of wealth? This is an age-old question. This is not a problem, a contemporary problem. This is not a problem of modernity. The great neoconservative theoretician, philosopher, Leo Strauss from University of Chicago, author of works like, The City and Man, that's a great one, City and Man, and also On Tyranny, it's a dialogue, it's a translation and critical notes on the dialogue of Socrates' other student, Xenophon, who talks with a hero who's a tyrant or like a despot. Okay. And that's the conversation that is had in that dialogue, among other typical Socratic, dialogue, although different from the way that it's iterated by Plato. You still educe a lot from this conversation. And in this conversation, they talk about how the ruler has to see himself as the state. He can't see himself as separate from the state for a lot of reasons, right? And the first one is, if the ruler sees himself, in other words, when we talk about, what was it? Was it Louis 16 or Louis 14? Excuse my ignorance, said that I am the state, right? Someone correct me on that in the comments, in the ongoing chat. Who was it? Was it 14 or 16 who said that? And he's criticized for this, and it's said to be kind of one of these things, sort of almost like let them eat cake or something, that kicked off the French Revolution. And this is, number one, not true, but with that statement. And number two, from the point of view of Socrates' student Xenophon in his dialogue with Hero the Tyrant, it comes out as true. What if, for example, what if Akhmatov or Kolomoisky saw the Ukrainian state as an extension of their own being? So, you're sick, you go to the doctor, you stay in health, you take a walk every day, you eat, whatever, a high fat, high vegetable and high animal fat diet. And you're healthy. What if they saw Ukraine as an extension of themselves? Well, they wouldn't sell something that's Ukrainian, like a natural resource or a factory or something, to a foreign investor in order to get a kickback that they personally get, you see. Because now they're seeing themselves as separate from the state. Does that make sense? Or imagine, and I think this allusion is made, standing on the terrace or the balcony and seeing the entire city, do you see yourself as, do you see the beauty of the city and everyday people going about their way smoothly and prosperous and peacefully, and trade and activity going on. Do you view that as you're trying to figure out your angle, like how you can profit from that? Or do you see that as in itself a good? It's a philosophical question. How we conceptualize property, private property, personal property, is historically contingent. It's not a universal, you own your body, but how we view things like titles, deeds, real estate, wealth, that extends beyond on that, even though many of these or much of these come into our custodianship as a result of our own merits, our own labors. What is our real relationship with it? And I know this sounds abstract. But given that it's Cinco de Mayo, the Battle of Puebla and the defeat of the French forces by Mexican Republic show that countries and people can recuperate from misleaders who sell the country off, who view themselves as personal actors acting for a personal angle and simply utilizing that position in government for self-enrichment, not seeing themselves as part of the society, not seeing their role as being that the success, how they define, because it's all sort of your own belief system. There are people very happy only being generous. Now, I'm not going to say that they get no happiness from it or it's completely that they're miserable. No, in fact, to the contrary, they find a lot of meaning and contentment in these pursuits, or think about monks. But many people have many choices all the time. There are many men and women that could have done all kinds of other professions that would have been higher risk, higher damage to others, higher reward. And they chose not to do those things, not because they were incapable or afraid or unwilling, but they find meaning in other things. But in politics, there are people after power and money, and those are the things that make them happy. Those are the things that they think makes them happy in these sort of short bursts, and then they're back in the cycle. The dopamine chasing, they're going to be chasing that forever, that dragon. And as we've explained, the psychology, the mentality of plutocrats. Now, this is different from what is called in DSM-4, DSM-5, in clinical psychology. It's bizarre to me, but I personally disagree with I disagree with the concept of the narcissist as an overarching, descriptive for all types of abusive people. But there's a type of narcissist that's called a communal narcissist who only gets narcissistic supply by bettering their community, by improving the lives of everyone around them. Okay. I mean, but just playing with that idea for a little bit, you could have leaders get into power who just want power so they can be very successful communal narcissists. Is that something you want? Maybe. You can see the term kind of loses meaning once it's actually you're just describing that people doing what's good for others, using power that they're after to do good for others. People are complex. They're not simple. There are many different ways to approach these questions. So, yes, this is our narrative about the great tragedy of Ukraine, unable to be a sovereign state. They proved to the world that they're not capable of managing. It's very sad, but we're trying to sketch here. We're actually drawing a picture about the relationship between power, how one conceptualizes themselves, what their purpose, what their commitments are. Just look at the outwardly expressed being of Kolomoisky. You can see the gluttony oozing from the pores of his big nose. You can see the sloth, the avarice. How many of the seven deadly sins for you Catholics out there, how many of the seven deadly sins can we, I think that's a useful framework, by the way. Sloth, gluttony, avarice. Avarice is like mammon worship. And there's so very little they can do. They're like after a number. It's like playing a video game and you're trying to get a high score, but once that's unplugged, it's off the screen and the score is done. And they can't really spend this money. They can only, you know, people talk about social credit, or they talk about digital money or coupons and how you're going to get paid in the future, but there's only going to be certain things you can buy and other things you can't buy. Do you know that these big billionaires live their lives like that already? There's like many things they cannot do with their own money. They're reminded every day that getting to claim that you have this money comes with a lot of responsibilities to the order of things, which include not rocking the boat. And you can't just buy out someone else because there's going to be lawsuits and there's going to be judges and there's always corruption and there's always ways that judges can be bribed or interpret the law, maybe even honestly, just against you. But we're talking about the club. And there's really, really limited ways that Kolomoisky can spend his money. Now they'll say, okay, you can do all the drugs. I mean, you know, millions of dollars is really nothing. Prostitutes, drugs. I know we talk about these a lot because we're trying to just understand what's the draw. Because it isn't making things happen. You don't need to, and it's a bigger liability to be the person whose name is on the money. You're not involved in every acquisition project or merger, whatever, within your empire. It's just this weird stuff that's going on under your nose all the time. And you can't keep up with it. And there's constantly people siphoning money off. There's you have a lot of employees, lawyers, always, you know, taking money from you. And you're losing your mind. You lose sleep over that shit if you worry about it. So then you're after more and bigger money. And you're like, okay, well, you know, then you project, well, they're just like me. I'm just like them. If it wasn't for me, it'd be someone else. So therefore, as George Soros says, it's not me. So that's the tragedy. It's really a human tragedy. I'm not saying that Ukrainians are uniquely incapable. This is something which happened to them. They were the victims of a collapsed geopolitical entity or empire, the Soviet Union. When the structures and norms went away, they were destroyed. And some of it's always processes that can appear internal, because they always rely on manipulating certain human behaviors internally, domestically, in Ukraine. There's no reason that Ukraine should have produced an Akhmatov or a Kolomoisky. The nouveau riche, the post-communist nouveau riche. And for everyday people, the only alternative is to be against Russia and be against your own oligarchy in a movement which is actually controlled by a foreign country or a foreign cabal. And that cabal was involved in destroying your country the first time, and they control the movements that arise in opposition to the conditions which that destruction created. It's problem, reaction, solution. And it's very, very, it's very sad, but it's disturbing, because it's a cautionary tale, and the things that happen in Ukraine can happen anywhere. There were several stolen elections that led to a civil war. That should be a pretty big wake-up call. You know, it doesn't really matter our own political views. If we're in the States or in Western Europe, doesn't matter. But maybe you're on the left, or maybe you're not a fan of Trump. That's irrelevant. If you really look at them, if you look at this question dispassionately, and look at the several very good neutral analysis that were done of like the bellwether states and the analysis of the exit polls and the polls going in, and how that election went down, and then looking at the changes in the election law. This outcome of the last U.S. election was admittedly changed, admittedly, by the Atlantic Council publications, Washington Post. They admittedly ran a project called the Transition Integrity Project to warn the Supreme Court to stand down. It was a shot across the bow. You had Zuckerberg going in, Democracy Action, Soros, SEIU. I know that one very well. I'm former SEIU, so I can speak to that. And that outcome was changed from what it would have been if the only thing that counted were how people voted. And that's the game that was played in Ukraine two times in a 10-year period. Number one in human trafficking, number one in sex trade, number one in organ trafficking, number one missing children, number one kidnap women and girls, Ukraine. These are facts. This is what happens when your country is run by merchants and not statesmen. Now let's dig into your let me look at what you guys are getting into here. I may have overposted where I was going to. No, I asked you for subjects. Just a moment. I'm just switching devices here.
All right, excellent. Here we are. The issue of political leadership in Ukraine, it should not surprise us what has happened, and it's a process happening in many, many countries, in many different cultures. And think about, if you would, your own prejudices. Think about your own default thinking. And think about whether you think it's natural that people whose primary interest has been theft or mercantile, you know, we're not saying that mercantile interest or trade is the same thing as theft, but at this level of the oligarchy, these things kind of merge, right? We're not talking about honest businessmen at all, are we? Think about, in your own default thinking, whether you right now think it's natural and normal that plutocrats are the ones making decisions, and that we have a culture being promoted for decades now and reinforced, let's say, by the World Economic Forum, who says that these private individuals, these merchants, are actually the stakeholders, and we need to have a stakeholder-driven society where the interests of these stakeholders are the interests that drive all of society. Let me ask you, just without all of that, does that, and I think the answer is actually, unfortunately, yes. This seems like a natural arrangement. This is how it's always been, right? And in thinking that it's always been that way, it seems like just how human beings are. And it seems to you like this is like a human nature. But what we're trying to say is that this is historically contingent within a particular society in a particular limited set of centuries, century or two. And it's geographically specific based upon those developmental peculiarities. But because of the success of projecting the illusion of a global monoculture, of global modernity in the way that we have in the West conflated Westernization with contemporariness. Isn't that interesting? To merge geography and time into a single concept called the truth, right? That's what we've done in the West, but we haven't only done that in projecting this value set across a geographic spatiality, but across temporal spatiality. Backwards in time, we've projected our value set onto all these different historical figures in the past. The biographies of these people and the analysis that we make are being made by contemporary historians who project the values of their society and the things that motivate our elites and our rulers and project those as the primary motivators under this universal concept, this rubric called human nature. So when the Akhmatovs and the Kolomoyskys of this world come in to do these things that they do, we think that this is a normal process. We think that in their competition and their monopolization schemes, when they buy and sell things which are actually critical to the public weal, to the public good, we have these ideas that we have these mixed, confused ideas where we take the ingenuity and proactiveness and thoughtfulness and dedication of the small entrepreneur, maybe the self-made millionaire, okay, which is a tremendous feat if that's your thing, or if the money came just as a consequence of some invention or some innovation or some game or some book or some movie, whatever that is that you did, some patent, patented molecule or medicine, whatever these things were, okay? We project that those types of things onto the plutocracy. And we allow their vision and their value system to become the dominant value system. And it's interesting, Karl Marx once said, I mean, it's consistent throughout his line of thinking, this materialist framework, that the ideas of the ruling class or the mentality of the ruling class become the ruling ideas of the age. And I think this point is true. And it contributes to this understanding that it would be a mistake, just to understand this right in a nutshell, it would be a mistake to think that Kolomoisky and Julius Caesar have fundamentally the same motivations and fundamentally the same understanding of power and the role of money and the role of the sea. That's the final, you know, underline, stroke, exclamation point, bold, red kapow, This is the stark contrast. Is it Julius Caesar? Is that the same as Igor Kolomoisky? Are these the same people? Were they produced by the same types of societies that have the same values? Did they have the same types of tutors? Did they read the same books? Do they have the same commitments? Do they have the same values? Do they have the same motivations? Did they use those things that they got in the same way? No, no, no. Wait, three, no, no, and no. This is how I think about these questions. This is how I think about history in this way. And that's good news. It's possible to generate a culture. It's so important. It's critical to it's the lifeblood of a civilization. It's culture. These terms are almost used interchangeably. But you can have a civilization in decay and it not have a very strong culture. And it's very unusual to have a very strong culture and not have an ascending civilization. Now, in the ideas of people like Spengler and others, there is a view that as civilizations have reached a certain pinnacle, that the culture within it at that time is not the same as the culture that made it rise, but actually it's a culture that arises out of the civilization in its pinnacle. And at that moment in time, you can say that as it has reached its top, it begins to decline. Did that happen in the West? Certainly, many themes and many practices, from collective struggle to delayed gratification, a strong tendency against nepotism, and the idea that you are attached to a community, and besides your two hands with which to work and whatever skills you have, your reputation, your honor, and your word are the most important things. It's the most important currency that you're going to have in your life are going to be your reputation. And without that, it's very, very hard to do anything. With the introduction in the West of social credit that we've actually already had, but we're ignorant about because we focus on a totally different civilization called China, from which we draw our collective anxieties, even though all the damage that China has done to the US has actually been done by our own plutocrats making deals with China, and China's just going to do China. Like, China's job is not to look out for what's good for American people. But we've had social credit already for a very long time. And that has taken people away from needing to have a reputation to be credit worthy by other people in your community, the local store, etc.,
or for a large project, remember, or maybe you've seen in movies, old movies, getting a bank loan and bringing in letters of recommendation from people, bringing in letters from people before the credit score. So just think about if this is what you think is normal. Do you think all of history has run this way? If you do, where did you get that impression? Was it a modern, was it a actually, in fact, modern piece of drama or modern writing that is depicting the distant past? Or is it actually a story from that time? Expectations are extremely important. And the expectations that you have of a society and the people around you are extremely important. Yes, there has always been corruption, but it is called corruption for a reason. And it's not supposed to be the norm. And even if it is more common in certain trades than others, if you have a culture that openly disapproves of it, you have laws and expectations and whistleblowers and people below it who are not happy with it. And you have this tension around it where it's not acceptable and not permissible. And this has a limiting effect on it. It doesn't eradicate it, but it has this limiting effect on corruption. But if you say this is human nature, and therefore, right, this here's the big leap, and therefore it should be permissible, is to say that all things are permissible. Because anything that a human being can do and is allowed to do and encouraged to do will become human nature of that culture in that time and place. So these are not universals. So this culture war is the background of actually a civilizational war. But this is not a clash of civilizations. This is a culture clash within societies. It's a form of the class struggle within societies, the cultural war. And the left, the new left, has gone over completely or almost completely to the side of the plutocracy and have become effectively the gendarmerie, the ideological gendarmerie of the plutocracy, operationalized and deployed into the field under this vague veneer of social justice, but in fact as the enforcers of big capital. And the same new left lives in an alternate reality where the plutocracy are patriarchal, conservative, with theocratic tendencies, heteronormative, and racist. And they are, in their minds, fighting against the ideas of a plutocracy when in fact that plutocracy hasn't promoted those ideas for decades and decades and decades, maybe four of them. Maybe five of them. Maybe 50 years, 40 years, 50 years. The plutocracy has not promoted those ideals for several generations. This is why the left, the new left, could look at the Maidan in 2014 and they could see the Femen, you know, like flat-chested girls that paint the stuff on their chest and the Pussy Riot, or maybe like a gay pride flag at the Maidan, and then imagine in their own fucking convoluted minds that this was progress, that this is social justice, that this is the movement, this is progress. This is the direction of things. This is the promise of tomorrow. This is what freedom looks like. This is what democracy looks like. In reality, the conservative ideas, and they have changed at the appropriate rate of change. Conservative in the rubric of modernity is just a corollary of the liberal. But the whole modernity is basically liberal. That is the ideology that triumphed in the 20th century over the other two ideologies of modernity, over fascism and over communism. And within that big liberalism, there's the little liberalism and conservatism. And that conservatism has slowed down the rate of liberalization within liberalism so that it could be democratized. The conservative element, I know this is bizarre, the conservative element is the democratic feature, is the democratizing feature, because all of the radical liberal agenda items are coming from the elites at a very high rate of speed or velocity or through time, very quickly. And these are foreign, too fast, too soon, unacceptable, misguided, not fitting where people are at. And so conservative acts as a check on those things. But that's not really the same thing as what are considered the ideas of the pre-capitalist world, the pre-modern world. If we say capitalism, modernity, okay. Fascist societies were capitalistic. Socialist societies, Marxist, communist societies were capitalistic. What do I mean by that? Well, by capital, we would simply mean that things have a value because they're scarce. That scarcity is driving values, that you have the law of value, right? You have the law, like the law of gravity. It's not a law like on the books. You can't abolish the law of gravity. You can't abolish gravity. Can't abolish the law of value. If you have things and you have people, and if you have more people than things, Now you have to, you know, you have scarcity. So there's different ways of regulating societies around scarcity, but they're all, it's all capital driven in modernity. There's just different ways. You can call it public, private, synergy, public, co-private, whatever. Those are all legal superstructural concepts, but at the level of the social relations, it's all very value driven. Value in terms of scarcity, not ethical value. So in looking at what had happened, what the left did is it calling it sort of like Marxism, but it's not. This is, I know it's weird. It's just, it is what it is. It is what it becomes. It is whatever people say it is what it becomes, obviously. But it's a critical error. In other words, if people don't understand their own fucking ideas, how seriously can you take them? Well, pretty seriously if they're dangerous, and there's a lot of them. But we want to also point out that the left doesn't understand its own ideas. If they did understand their own ideas, they would actually seem a lot more normal, and their conclusions would be a lot more normal. If they actually understood their own ideas, as funny as that may sound to some of you, and we can prove it. The main problem had been, that the new left tried to make it look like traditionally conservative views of personal conduct and personal choices, values and ethics, and how those should be multiplied through individuals at such a high number that it characterizes society itself, right? Okay. The new left tried to act as if the conservative worldview, there's many, but we're just generalizing it at significant cost, but we have to deliver an idea at a certain point, right? The conservative view was the product of capitalism. And that therefore, their highly personalized definition of hedonistic freedom, do what thou will shall be the whole of the law, Anton LaVey, the Satanist, the new left decided, landed on, promoted the view that this transhumanism, that this identity politics of the sexual, of the racial, and of the personal, person in constant quest to discover themselves, that to find yourself. It's much more simple than this, you see. It's there you are. That's you. There you are. Nothing else to find. It's about what you do, who you are, not what you find. Imagine that as a life, just looking at your belly button to discover yourself. I don't mean to insult actually what is a great religious tradition of the Hesiodic, but they did that switch. You see, it's actually when your society is run by merchants who are hedonists, and that is their what they call capitalist society, okay? Those become the value sets of all of society. So why people are so confused about, like, you know, big dicks coming out of cartoon, like Disney drawings and shit, and what all this craziness, like, and they think that this is like some communist plot. And it's like, no, this is the hedonism. This is the hedonism of your quote unquote capitalist ruling class. This is not Disney trying to do communism. This is Disney doing hedonism. Is Kolomoisky wasn't after billions and billions of dollars and personal wealth and personal power to bring you Stalin. This is about his fucking trip. And you're in the way. It's hedonism. Okay, that is the modernity ideology. The new left took the medieval, the feudal system based in some notions of chivalry and the relationships and the interdependence that different classes and estates have in society, and how that works on the macro scale and on the micro scale, how that involves concepts of first courtly and then romantic love, the extended and then the nuclear family, all of these things that the new left calls bourgeois are actually feudal. Conservative worldview is ultimately a feudal, and not in the way that the Austrian economics, you know, the subjective theory of value people mean by feudalism. That's not like Hayek and we're talking about the historical stage, historical phase in the development of societies called feudalism. That conservative ideas are the feudal ones. Okay. Now, one of the conceptual dilemmas, why we misunderstand Akhmatov, Kolomoisky, or even Elon Musk or Bill Gates, how we don't understand this is rooted in the peculiarity of that weird transition period in the middle 19th century where Karl Marx was actually writing, when he was looking at a society that was still largely semi-feudal and believed it was fully capitalist, when really it was still very much the middle of the 19th century in Germany, right? And he takes that, and he takes these feudal values, and he seems to attribute to them a bourgeois character, because of course the ruling class at this time has had a mixture of both feudal and bourgeois, you know, values. And because the ruling class was managing a society that was a mixture of both. Okay. But the new left, 100 years later, should have known better. So Karl Marx can make that mistake. Karl Marx can make an error in 1860. Okay. But in 1960, you have no fucking business making that mistake. You should see that a society based on individual wealth aggregation, accumulation, individual, that it's based in avarice, okay, gold fever, right? How many people would you kill to defend your pile of gold, you know? How many? And how it was that the social theorists from the Frankfurt School, from the French post-structuralists, the German Frankfurters, Adorno, Habermas, Habermas, really, actually, quite frankly, brilliant. Habermas, I think, actually went against the grain. Habermas is really brilliant in his analysis of the public sphere. Many of my understanding of the difference between the reality of feudal relations comes from, in part, a book called The Foundations of Christianity by Karl Kautsky, and the and much later written, maybe, you know, several decades, at least 30 years later, Habermas, Jürgen Habermas, on the, I think it's called like the structure of the social square or something like this. It's a book that I lent out and shouldn't have and didn't get it back. Ex Libris. Someone in the comments who's listening, find that Habermas, see if you can get the prize in the comment section to come up with that book. Habermas, it's great. You take Kautsky, you take Habermas, and maybe some Leo Strauss, Hero the Tyrant, Tyrannicus Hero. Put those together, and you get a very good idea about belief systems, ideology, and the temporal nature, the spatial and temporal nature of fixedness, limitedness of these things, these ideas, human nature, belief systems that are actually contingent in certain paradigms. Now, whereas the Marxists say that things are improving, we might say that things are declining. You can't really have, you can have a period of decline in a paradigm, and maybe those are for reasons not critical to the structure or nature of the paradigm, but you can't maintain a worldview of history that the general tendency is progress and improvement when you have a whole historical paradigm, a whole historical epic, which sees the continual decline and degradation of even critical faculties. How much has IQ declined in the past 100 years? Have you seen what the exit exam of an eighth grader in 1880 was? So you're talking about a 13-year-old, their exit exam. You wouldn't pass it. I mean, you would study for it and you would pass it as an adult, but you wouldn't. Unless you were doing trigonometry as, like, if you didn't use a computer and you were like an architect or something, maybe a chemist. Other than that, so there's been a continual decline. You can't explain what has happened to Ukraine, and you can't explain Ukraine's relationship with its oligarchy outside of the context of the overall ideological push coming from the far West. Think about Margaret Thatcher. who said there's no such thing as society. What better fertile soil for people like Kolomoisky and Akhmatov to emerge and to be coddled and raised up and taken into the bosom of this far Western extremist ideology to say that society is not real is actually what they mean to say. They say does not exist, and that's a play on words because obviously society doesn't exist. It's a reality. Existence obviously requires location, orthogonality, you know, the volume, mass, right? Society is kind of the whole thing. It's a dynamic, it's a movie, not a picture. There's no smell of society. What does it look like? I understand it's not an empirical fact, does not exist. But it's actually even more profound than that. Human beings are capable of this concept of society in their heads as they go on about in society doing things. And by having that concept of society in your head, you might not do things that might harm that society if you saw yourself as part of that society. This is right back to Leo Strauss, and well, really, it's Xenophon. In his discourse with Hero the Tyrant, his conversation. Super important reading material, University of Chicago, Leo Strauss on tyranny. And in many ways, we've been worried about tyrants and not looking at plutocrats. Because we might look at the tyranny of public officials and public oppression coming from these elected people, politicians, and we might look at things that they do as tyrannical. But the reason that we feel these things as tyrannical is not just because that's the only way that power is exercised, but it's in the interests of the plutocracy. Now, you might be trying, you might have a life goal, bro, to be a plutocrat. And you might actually exist in a functioning society that is in the ascending period where the culture is strong and people feel strong sense of socialness, of responsibility in the conservative sense. And you may be trying to be a plutocrat and then you get in and you end up breaking a lot of laws because in those societies there are laws against being a plutocrat. And you might decry, this is tyranny. This is tyranny. The government is interfering with my ambition to be a plutocrat. Now, of course, governments can take things far too far. But they tend to do things really nasty to broad numbers of people, to the largest numbers of people, when they do so at the behest of plutocrats. Now, they can call it a Nazi state, they can call it a liberal state, they can call it a socialist, it doesn't matter. You're going to have these Kolomoiskys who are kind of manipulating things For example, this problem reaction solution issue of the Ukrainian Nazis that we talk about, how that's their only option. The other options have been ruled out by historical cultural circumvention. Either they're not going to be marching on May 9th, Victory Day, and they're not pro-Soviet. That option is not there. Even though there are strong anti-plutocratic sentiments in that direction, they can't be against their own plutocracy but embrace the Soviet anti-plutocratic model, because that's contrary to the national idea of Ukraine as victim of the Holodomor and the Soviet Union and things like that, you see. And then they're not going to embrace the same liberalism and hedonism of Europe, not because they see effect on their own. They don't want their daughters to grow up to be prostitutes, okay? But they identify that Western hedonism quite correctly. We're talking about, like, you know, extremism and Nazism in Ukraine. They quite correctly identify that hedonism as exemplified in the caricature of the Kolomoyskys of their time and place. You see the conundrum? You see this problem? Then when the new left sees the Ukrainians as victims, as trapped in Azovstal, of course, we should never grow cold in the heart. We should never become hardened and cynical. We should always be in the moment that we are in. And if we see footage of some Ukrainian civilians that have been injured or killed by a Russian missile, we should feel something like sympathy, empathy for these people. But what we should not, the context of this tragedy are the forces of people, the forces in power behind it, which made this inevitable. Not that we're looking at every instance of a tragedy as the reason why this conflict could have been avoided, because it couldn't have been avoided. It could not have been avoided . The best evidence of that, if you understand reality as a causally connected chain sequentially through time, through causation, right? Each thing leading to the next. It was inevitable. There are no leaders. There are no plutocrats in the U.S. who grew up poor, number one. Number two, there are no plutocrats or politicians in the U.S. who have experienced or lived through a total war. And when you take these together, you're going to produce a culture at the level of political leadership which does not appreciate the brevity of life and the finality of death. To think that you could just keep extending this chaos situation to create a failed state, a Nazi caliphate out of a failed state in Ukraine, and to allow and to script or to have their actor Zelensky talk about, we want to have nuclear weapons. I hope that we are seeing a bigger picture here. There is actually, it's weird in the West, the way that the political map has been manipulated and has emerged, especially in the US, where you have like two parties and it basically they're big tent systems. Because why would you have in one party mutually antagonistic contradictory concepts and in the other party have mutually antagonistic concepts, or, you know, not concepts aren't things, but people whose motivations or interests as they understand them are actually quite mutually contradictory? You can't be simultaneously for infinite economic growth, and you can't be simultaneously for deregulating monopolies and deregulating banks and deregulating businesses, and also be a patriot, and also be a, and also support family values, because those are those that process is actually called globalization. Of ever deregulating business, ever deregulating banks, the ever increasing financialization of every sphere of life, that's called the total subsumption of capital by capital. You can't actually hold that view that that's a good thing as traditionally Republicans were known to support. The Wall Street Republicans, the New England Republicans, right, is a very different thing. And then with Democrats, for example, I mean, there's many contradictions here. How could you be pro-labor and be pushing for a more equitable piece of the pie for the working man, and also call for open borders, which is contrary to the interests of working people from both countries, because now you have a race to the bottom, as the labor market, supply and demand, common sense would indicate. It increases unemployment. And this is how the system operates. They compartmentalize different truths into different areas. That's why we can talk openly here. Despite that, I've received a letter from the Treasury Department warning me of my dealings with and warning me of that I could violate the sanctions, still being under investigation from the people preparing the reports for the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. I live under a lot of fucking stress. And then, like many other people who I respect, many different types of people, from all different walks of life and viewpoints, and myself included, we all had our PayPals permanently obliterated and not allowed to open up any new accounts. And these are not accidental. Obviously, these are done to have a silencing effect on people. And one has to decide if they're going to live that way, if they're going to kneel. And of course, we won't. I think the PayPal thing is relatively minor. Mine had actually been frozen under investigation for something like 18 months, and I haven't been able to use it. And they've been asking me questions about my NGO that I've answered, and they would ask the same question again. And it became, some of the information requests became actually onerous and contrary to how information requests can normally work, or asking for information about third-party individuals that in my capacity I don't have, you know, because an NGO says other people, members, and they want to know how the decision-making process works. PayPal wanted to know how the decision-making process works in the NGO about how the money is spent. It supports my research, assholes. What the fuck do you think it does? But yes, they've been going after a lot of people. But I consider the PayPal thing to be relatively minor compared to the, you know, the Mossad and the FBI and the CIA and MI5, MI6 rats and spooks up my ass for years. You kind of grow a thick skin. You know what it is, and it's nothing against anyone else. It's just, but when people who are doing literally nothing, like subversive at all, and they're like, don't want to use an app to talk to me, like, because they're afraid. It's like, I understand the principle and you're right. And I'm not saying if you have nothing to, you know, hide, then you should not be worried, because that's not how prosecutions work at all. You know, never talk to the police at all. But, you know, I have it reasonably well mapped out how this privacy and persecution thing works from firsthand experience. And at a certain point, you just don't give a fuck. You just got to be authentic and let, you know, somewhere between God and history will be the judge. And that's how it goes. Now, all of this ties in our analysis of the tragedy of Ukraine, starting with Cinco de Mayo, Cinco de Drinco, the Battle of Puebla, the defeat of the French, how Benito Juarez told the French, we're not going to pay this debt that illegitimate governments in the past who were your family members or whatever, like, imposed on Mexico. It doesn't mean that it's the sovereign debt of Mexico. Go F yourself. And so then the French invade, and ultimately their occupation fails. It was actually a guerrilla war that they couldn't maintain constant attacks on their soldiers, their garrisons. It was a slow bleed war of attrition, but the Battle of Puebla was huge, a huge symbolic defeat for the French. It rallied the Mexican forces, Mexican patriotism against really Mexico's own plutocracy, and in the French control of attempt to control Mexico in different times they controlled Mexico, they would bring back some Habsburg or something. There were Mexicans on that side too. Just like in Ukraine, how you have the government is totally controlled by foreign powers. But the people in the government don't have that belief system. Isn't that interesting to you? You can have a government that's controlled by a foreign cabal, but you can have an ideology which is so pro-state and so pro-Ukraine that it's like unthinkable. You know, it's like normally the biggest anti-gay crusader is like, you know, often gay. Or what did Lavrov say? The biggest Nazis are often Jews. He got in trouble for that the other day. The biggest Nazis are often Jews, Lavrov said. He also said, and wasn't Hitler part Jewish? He says, correct me if I'm wrong on that, but that's my understanding. I think he knows he's Lavrov. This is a sophisticated, highly attentive student of history, minutia and details. I think he said that knowing, being polite and saying, you know, forgive me, correct me if I'm wrong. That the Shekelgruber family was Jewish. That's Hitler's actual birth surname, is Shekelgruber. Like a shekel, dude. Gruber? Gruber? Shekel Grabbler? Awful. So there you have it, folks. Now, this opens up for us in coming episodes, in upcoming installments of our series. We're going to get back to state the Klaus Schwab book, the new one, Stakeholder Capitalism, A Global Economy That Works for Progress, People, and Planet. By the way, as a youth, I remember the People's, the Daily World, or the People's Weekly World from the CPUSA. I think they actually, I think the communists actually in America had the expression for people before profits, for an economy that worked for progress, people, and planet. I think that was the CPUSA. I think the World Economic Forum took it from the Communist Party USA. I think so. It's very, very nearly identical phrasing. For those who had access to my book review, it's very, you know, informal. It's just a pile of about 30 books on my bed, and I go through each cover and I show you the books. I said, this one's about this, this one's about that. These are the main books to understand globalization, the Great Reset, from the point of view of the people designing it. So we talked about Polanyi, the Great Transformation, Jeremy Rifkin, the Zero Marginal Cost Society. Also, he wrote the Third Industrial Revolution. There's Schwab's books. Stakeholder Capitalism is the latest one. And Igor Kolomoisky is a stakeholder. Do you see the problem with this? Zelensky announced that Ukraine is the first society, the first country. What was it that he said? It was the first, and that it was for, or, you know, the terms, I don't want to misquote him, but what was communicated in some other words very close to this, but didn't sound as negative. I just can't find the word, excuse me. But he said that this is the that Ukraine is the first country controlled by the stakeholders of the World Economic Forum. He didn't use the word controlled, like open. He didn't say open to investment. He said open to, or open for, the stakeholders, or the decisions of Ukraine are made by the stakeholders of the global economy. That's it. That's it. And when you talk about, when you looked at, people talk about stakeholders. Just understand that this is moving away from shareholders, and it's trying to, I could kind of explain it. I don't want to get off our subject too much, although that has been our subject, is kind of exploring this whole terrain around the periphery of this crisis in Ukraine and the World Economic Forum and the Great Reset and the ideologies of a time period. Are these universal human nature, we asked, or are these kind of more specific to a time and place, like i.e. a paradigm, right? An historical epic. Or are these universal? And of course, there's some mix in between, yeah, because there are universal aspects to human nature. I mean, you know, but different people respond differently when they find a $100 bill on the ground. And those are not determined as much by their need, but by their sense of who they are and what makes them happy, what makes them feel like they've done something good. Do they keep, or do they find, if they knew who it was, like if they saw the person who dropped it, do they say, excuse me, you dropped this? This is like a big money thing you dropped? Or do they keep it? Now, the Great Reset and Ukraine are one and the same. And when you look at how they are trying to manage our perceptions of who stakeholders are, they've gotten away from this concept of the shareholder, okay? And they're positioning the Schwabian perspective is being artificially contrasted and compared in the negative to the Friedmanian, the Milton Friedman worldview, which is that the role of businesses is not to make overt attempts to shape society around it, but rather should only be interested in meeting its fiduciary responsibilities to the shareholders, not the stakeholders, the shareholders. Now, what had happened in the unfortunateness or the inevitabilities of development of modernity had been that, like, concepts like socialism and communism are these big state building projects where you have, you know, government bureaucrats making decisions for everyone else in life. But there had been this other idea that had also come up through extremism of extremist beliefs within organized labor. Some of these often were anarchists, socialists, and communists, but there was this other idea, somewhat more like, kind of like anarchism or syndicalism, where you have a shareholder society that everyone should own shares, but that there should be limits, controls on how fast you can buy and sell them. In other words, you can't pump and dump. You're not holding them that when you own a share, it's not because you think that your algorithm says that by the end of today it's going to increase by 0.2% in value, so you're going to buy 1,000 shares and then sell them when it hits that number, like a day trader, which is all fine and good. It's great even. But that a shareholder society would be everyone. Imagine if your salary itself were dividend driven, where if you worked, you were a co-owner, and the owners of the company, in order to grow to a certain level within the, you know, because there's like laws about monopolies and things like this, access to maybe different considerations. Maybe the state will pave you a road to your entrance and things like this, right? To get to a certain level and size limits the amount of ownership that the owners can have, and the employees are the shareholders. And then because employees are also human beings that live in the physical place, they may not elect to make decisions about the company that undermine their own community. Maybe it's a health issue, like chemical toxins or pollution or noise pollution or whatever, or about where they need to be on target. If they are the shareholders, then they make the shareholders happy, not only by increasing, let's say, the viability or profitability of that enterprise, but also if the work itself is meaningful, or conversely, if you find the trade-off worth it. So there was this other concept of a shareholder society, which is not a bad one. I don't know how applicable it is today as we move towards the fourth industrial revolution, which decentralizes production to the point that the number of shareholders for any given enterprise would probably be smaller today as we move towards decentralization than it would have been in the 20th century with the rise of Taylorism and Fordism and the large industrial plants. Think about Azovstal, right? What does Azovstal look like in the world of 3D printing 50 years from now? So there are many things which change in our social organization pursuant to our physical economic organization. So Ukraine, if every citizen, and almost every citizen is a worker, if every citizen of Ukraine is a voter in terms of how they vote in the body politic, but also a shareholder who votes at the shareholders meeting of that thing, okay, then they have these different bodies that they're involved in and they balance out. You have this, you do have a separation of powers, and you do have these different communities that you are a member of where you are both a shareholder, and because you are a shareholder, you are a stakeholder. Okay. What? Because you have a dog in that race. But you own that dog, and you have to have ownership of these things to have a stake, to be a stakeholder. And the only way that we are all stakeholders with a voice is if we have an ownership society. There's different ways to conceive of that, and we can't rewrite the history, nor are we suggesting to revisit the way that history necessarily had to happen. But moving forward and looking into the future, you can see what types of things are possible and what types of things are desirable. And you're going to find far more traction. You're going to gain far better traction having conversations with people about the kind of world that you all want to live in from this day forward, free of political jargon and ideological terms than is if you decide, as opposed to having a debate about different ways the past could have been. Like, how pointless is that? How pointless is it to talk about the way things could have been? I know I like to bring things back down to the level of romantic relationships, but you could always understand these questions of power, abuse of power, if you're making the wrong decision, if the conversation is being framed the wrong way. When you think about it in terms of the power dynamic in a relationship. Always having the power to walk away. And the social contract is no different. So, society was supposed to be designed to be an improvement over the wild. And if society is no longer an improvement over the wild, then the wild is the place to be. It's society has to make the pitch to you that it is worth being in society for you. It is not your job to prove your worth to society. Just like I am not here to prove my worth to my significant other. Or, for example, if I'm Ukraine, I'm not here to prove that I'm European. Because that proof, that criteria of what's considered proof, is created by the counterparty, by the other party, as a method of controlling you. Just think about when someone says, if you really loved me, you would blah, blah, blah. That should be like a red light. I mean, maybe they're right in that moment. I mean, you know, but that's a very dangerous expression that lends itself often to a lot of abuse in relationships, does it not? If you really were Europeans, guys, Ukraine, you would go die, like all of you, like fuck it, why not, right? Like all of you, fighting Russia to protect and defend the rest of Europe. Since clearly we're all in. Since clearly we're all in with you. How many more 1980s pieces of crap can we send? We were supposed to get rid of this year anyway. Germany with its 4 days of ammunition. So, this is our way of understanding it. Coming up, I said again, tomorrow we will get into the empathic civilization, which is Jeremy Rifkin book, huge book. Empathic civilization. We talk a lot prior to this conflict, and you know, guys joining us now, we actually deal a lot with understanding the Great Awakening, how the Great Awakening has also been understood or distilled or, you know, refined through the understanding of the ruling class, how they understand the Great Awakening, how they maybe try, how they want to surf or exploit. Manipulate the Great Awakening, their proof of concept on that is Jeremy Rifkin's book called The Empathic Civilization. He's also the guy who wrote The Zero Marginal Cost Society, which is madness. It's just sheer and utter insanity. Rifkin is an important thinker behind all of these concepts. Even though Rifkin's job is to speak to the left, and we've talked about this social democratic left, it's an academic left, it's the professor's left. These are people who were Marxists in their youth, but never strayed far from the university campus. And after the collapse of the Soviet Union and books by Hart and Negri, like The Multitudes and things like that, Empire and things like that, they kind of moved into this more, Zizek kind of idea that, well, even though we have these radical ideas, the most that we can probably do is just kind of tweak consumerism here and there just a little bit. And if they're going to do globalization, then let's put a friendly face on globalization. Let's stop calling it imperialism. Let's start calling it humanity. They're going to privatize everything. And since they're just going to get away with that, and since we're powerless to stop that, then what we're going to do is just make sure there's as much inclusiveness as possible, so that white people and black people can both be exploited at the same rate of exploitation by these multinationals. That will be a great step in the direction of justice for all. If we can just, equalize the misery, then that will have been a great success. These are the thinking. So then when you have, they're completely defeatist. They have no orientation towards the deplorables, for Les Miserables, for we the people to do anything. They see things in terms of defeat, and from their ivory towers, they say, oh, well, look, now the ruling class is saying that we should have a global economy that works for progress, people, and planet. So Klaus Schwab maybe understands something, or maybe this is just, there's been a paradigm shift, and now the ruling class is getting it because, hey, we all have this planet together, and the environment affects all of us. So we certainly can't have a society based on limitless growth. And, that's why we haven't had a nuclear war. And that's why we're going to make a Green New Deal, because the ruling class also lives on Earth with us, and there are things that you can't escape. That's their thinking. Okay, you can agree with parts of that or not. It's all good. I'm just explaining to you how the ivory tower post-left or disgruntled ex-radical left intellectuals understand the world, and why Jeremy Rifkin and even Klaus Schwab are like these great breaths of fresh air for these leftist academics. Because they long ago, they're like, okay, the working class isn't going to do anything. They totally are allergic to workers and self-employed, small business. They're totally alert. They don't even understand how that works. They don't even understand what freedom looks like when you don't have a boss. It's beyond their... It's not on the radar screen at all. Once you work without a boss other than yourself, number one, you'll never work so much in your life. And number two, you'll never realize that you're working when you're working, just because you're working all the time. And you're accountable to you, which is the most important person to be accountable to. When your freedom's on the line, you're not going to surrender that. But that's why these academics love Jeremy Rifkin, and that's why they love Klaus Schwab, when they say things like, you'll own nothing and you'll be happy, because in their minds, owning nothing means that there's nothing to pursue, but it means that you're going to be taken care of, because that seems to be what's being proposed here, that everyone's just going to be on UBI. And you have Harari saying, you know, you just have to be on drugs and video games. So we're going to dig into this in our next episode. We also are going to return to the smart cities, Panopticon, Foucault, Bentham. I have an expose lined up for you to show you how the mainstream, most like esteemed academics that are absolutely have gone totally just pro-fascist, openly fascist. It's in black and white ink. We're going to expose that for you guys. That's going to be coming up in the next couple of days. I will have to organize some time to focus just on some of Leo Strauss's ideas. And again, it's like there's bad ones, there's good ones. There's Leo Strauss's The City and Man. There's Max Weber's The City. Leo Strauss on Tyranny. These are important to put together. And from understanding this, also maybe Marc Cusé's One Dimensional Man, we can compare these and understand the Great Reset and the thinking behind this. And when we compare the thinking behind it, and when we compare actually looking at their plans and how they want to arrange things, and how much this COVID thing, how much was riding on this COVID thing to accomplish that, you're going to come away not only more informed, empowered, and educated, I believe, but you're also going to see how the Great Reset, as they have it lined up, is failing. And just as an aside, very much this has to do with timelines. When these things get put into place, when these things get introduced, and which pieces of them are the important pieces, and which one pieces are not the important pieces, but might scare you anyway. Which pieces are important and how the technologies are developing. That has to do with the timelines as well. So that's going to be our curriculum for the coming week. We're going to, again, develop further on stakeholder capitalism, looking at Jeremy Rifkin. In between, we'll, like, as things are developing in Ukraine, we'll do separately live stream just on events or things going on with Ukraine. But we're going to, in this series, develop on the empathic civilization, Jeremy Rifkin. We're going to connect that to the Great Awakening and how they understood that the Great Awakening was going to happen. It has a lot to do with Maslow's hierarchy of needs and things like this, but not how you might think. It's not at the pinnacle, but once the pinnacle has been reached and then there's a degradation of the pinnacle, we'll explain it. Very good. I think this is good for today, at least good enough. I want to thank you all for joining us, and have a great rest of the day. I know I will. Bye-bye.